I won't have it.
Good afternoon. I will call to order the first meeting of the House Committee on Land Use for the 2009 session, and welcome everyone here. We have a very distinguished panel to help us get some perspective on the task in front of us. And before we do that, I would like to give the committee members an opportunity not only to introduce ourselves briefly to each other, but to the public who is here in the room and the public who is watching us. I'm Representative Mary Nolan. This is my fifth term in the legislature. I represent a district that includes Southwest Portland, downtown, the riverfront, and the Southwest Hills. Representative Cowan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Jean Cowan. I represent District 10, which is the Central Oregon coast, Lincoln County, Northern Lane County, parts of Polk, Yamhill, and Tillamook County. This is my second term here, and prior to that, I was a county commissioner in Lincoln County for 12 years, so land use is not new to me.
I'm Brian Clem. I represent portions of Central and East Salem, actually right out to the urban growth boundary, and then it stops. And on the east side of Salem, it's a very clear one. It's pretty much farmland and a lot of houses right on the line, like it's theoretically designed to be. I'm the chair of the House Ag, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. And as we know, agriculture and land use go hand in hand in the Willamette Valley particularly, so very passionate interest of mine as well.
Good afternoon. My name is Bruce Hanna. I'm a state representative from House District 7. I represent vast portions of northern Douglas and southern Lane County, Oregon's fifth largest district. I make a living as a Coca-Cola bottler and do significant land development type projects of commercial size. So I'm very interested in what we do in committee.
I'm Chris Garrett, a new member of the House. I am from Lake Oswego, represent House District 38, which includes all of Lake Oswego and parts of southwest Portland.
Representative Sal Esquivel, I'm from Medford. All of my constituency lives within the city of the city limits of Medford, except for 14 people. That's my rural community. I'm a realtor in my profession. I've been in the legislature now. I was appointed in the Senate, and then this is my third term in the House.
I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. I'm very happy to be back on this distinguished panel with Representative Nolan. We served together on the Land Use Committee in the 2005 session where I was vice chair, and I served on the Land Use Committee in 2003. My district includes the northwest section of Portland, unincorporated Multnomah County, and half of it unincorporated Washington County, all the way from the Multnomah County line out to North Plains. So land use has been a particular issue, urban growth boundary questions and questions of annexation and other things that touch on land use has been very much on my mind. And I've had as a particular concern the land use issues around Forest Park and maintaining it as a viable community asset over the next few years, next 100 years.
I'm Matt Wingard. I represent House District 26, which includes the communities of Wilsonville and Sherwood and Bull Mountain and all of rural Washington County out to Gaston. It's all of southern Washington County out to Gaston, and includes Hag Lake. So the district is geographically about half suburban, dense suburban, and the other large section of it is rural nurseries, farmland, large tracts like that. And this is my first term in the legislature.
Welcome. And throughout the session, we will have the support and guidance of a couple of very capable committee staff people. Please introduce yourself, Josh.
My name is Joshua Poit.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm Cheyenne Ross.
And also the committee will have access to some staff support from my senior advisor, Amy Abbott, who schedules things for me, including will help Cheyenne and Joshua with scheduling for the committee. Welcome. First order of business is adoption of committee rules. These are standard committee rules that are being adopted for all committees. They're pretty standard. The only principal change, at least, that I'm aware of since last session is the addition of requirements for fiscal impact statements or revenue impact statements before bills can move out of substantive committees like this. But they are coterminous with the other committee rules. So, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, I move adoption of the committee rules, Madam Chair.
Discussion on the motion to adopt the rules, Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Madam Chair. I, as a matter of style, even though I know the modern usage has switched to this, I am concerned about the term shall be comprised of in item 2, which I think more properly, historically, should say shall comprise a. But I understand this is the way the style manual was going. More is a pity. The world as we know it is in danger. But I'm perfectly willing to vote for this for these minutes.
Thank you, Representative.
I hope this doesn't split us, Mitch.
Further discussion? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a point that I hope you will clarify and also commit to, given that the House rules now require minority reports include language first proposed in committee as LC amendments, I would hope you would commit to, within the committee, at least hearing those amendments in committee and passing them out.
Representative, if any member of this committee wants to move an amendment, I will hear and accept that motion. But if someone wants to present an amendment but not move it, I'll honor the author's preference on that.
And that will qualify it for a minority.
That will qualify it for use in a minority report, as long as it is made available to the committee chair and the committee administrator. I won't out someone, Representative, who does not want to have discussion on their amendment, but I will make sure it goes in the record so it is available.
So it is available.
Yes.
Thank you.
You bet. Any further discussion? Any objections? Motion carries. We're official. The challenges facing this committee this session will be pretty complex. The opportunities, I think, are also pretty tantalizing because we have an opportunity to advance the vision and the effectiveness of land use planning in the state in ways that can, in fact, give us an opportunity to preserve things that are wonderful and productive for our state for dozens of years, for generations to come. So it is both a daunting and an enticing task that we face. Beginning today and for the next 2 weeks, what I plan for this committee is to make sure that we share a common understanding of the background. That doesn't mean we have to share a common perspective on it or position on it or philosophy, but I want everyone on the committee to benefit from some of the history of what has brought us to the point where we think it's important enough to have a committee dedicated to land use this session. So you will see over the next 2 weeks a series of opportunities for us to hear from people as well as segments of our economy, different diverse communities around the state geographically who have helped shape the land use system as it is today and who want to help us shape it as it moves forward. I could think of no better way to start that than to invite someone who served on the committee that passed Senate Bill 100 back in 1973. We have the benefit today of hearing some of the history, both grandiose and a little bit, I suspect, of behind-the-scenes negotiations that led to that. Former Governor Attia, former Senator at that time Attia, is here to help set the stage for us. Mr. Governor, welcome.
Thank Chair, you invited me to come down when I was here Monday. And I really have not traveled a great deal back and forth from my home since I left Salem. So I'd say to myself, why would I want to do this? And I have to tell you that in terms of, she asked, and I said immediately yes. That wasn't a question, just a matter of whether I had this day available. And it's because I really do believe in land use planning. But it always amazed me that this state of Oregon, in which a great migration came out here, and they came out here because they wanted their own land. That's what they came for. And yet Oregon was the first state that said, now wait a minute, we're going to be a little more restrictive on how you're going to use your land. And I thought to myself, that's quite unusual. Now, that doesn't mean it was non-controversial. As a matter of fact, in my career, I opposed the repeal of Senate Bill 100 a number of times. I'm going to broaden the perspective a little, but I'm not going to depart from talking about land use. Because I think it's important that you get a sense of where you are today, not only in land use, but in the rest of your session with your other people. Monday, you did start on your journey, your version of how Oregon should be for the future. And interesting as it might be, at least it's interesting to me, that's a journey I began 50 years ago to the day, January 12th, 1959. Incidentally, I left office as a public office after 28 years on January 12th also. And so I've seen a lot. Much of what is new or relatively new to you has happened time after time during my political career. It's happened before. Of course, the faces have changed. Incidentally, we talk about term limit. I counted during my 28 years as a member of the legislature and as a governor, I served for 318 different legislators. Now, that's term limit enough. By that, I mean, you don't have to have term limit. It just happens. Attitudes have changed. Where either the Democrats or the Republicans are the enemy. One thing that hasn't changed, I'm still the last Republican governor. I keep hearing that. Now, during my 28 years, I want to just, and this is where I'm going to broaden it, because I want to let you know the challenges that took place during a 28-year period of time. And it doesn't include land use planning, of course. We had, for the first time in my career, an environmental committee. Never was one. And it happened to be in the Senate. Passed the first environmental law in regard to water quality and created the Department of DEQ. We passed the beach bill, bottle bill, Senate Bill 10, in 71, which said, you've got to do that, city and county, and if you don't do it, we'll do it. And then came along the next session, Senate Bill 100, which supposedly was 10 times better than Senate Bill 10. That was highly controversial, highly emotional. I was on the committee. And if you even pause to say, hey, this we shouldn't be doing that, all of a sudden you become the person that doesn't want land use planning. And I want land use planning. But there were many, many things in the bill. I don't know where it came from, who invented the bill. I have no idea. Of course, I know who introduced the bill. And I know that Tom McCall was very much for it. But it was, and it was expected to be, just like I said earlier, Oregon was a country that people came to because they wanted land. And so it's got to be controversial. But it did pass, which was interesting. But there was a lot of heat. And then we created the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Now, I said that whole thing out because LCDC is what we've heard, which is land conservation. But somehow the people forgot the D, which was development. They can say, you know, it's conservation, but development, heck, that was not a thing that they concerned themselves with. That, incidentally, the land use bill, which was made mandatory, the fact that you had to have your plan, city and county, acknowledged by the state with certain standards, with four extra ones for the coast. And it took then 13 years for that to be concluded. 13 years. In the meantime, it was almost a moratorium on any kind of progression because everything that came through in land use planning was an exception. Because there wasn't, incidentally, a city or county that had a plan. Once they had the plan, then it moved according to the plan. Before you had a plan, there was an exception. I tell you that incidentally because I was on the idea for economic development and it was very hard to tell people that they ought to come to Oregon when we don't know whether that land was available that they wanted. And
what you were concerned about.
In Beaverton...
Mr. Governor, the audience can't hear you. If you could get a little closer to the mic because we want the audience to hear your history as well as the members of the committee.
What am I not? You want me to talk into this thing?
Just bring the mic a little closer.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
All right.
Everyone wants to hear what you say.
Hey,
they're sitting
you.
On the edge of their seats trying to hear you.
Okay. There were some pretty strange things that were going on. In Beaverton, incidentally, I represented Washington County in my career as a legislator. In Beaverton, if you wanted to do something in terms of land use, it took 58 weeks to get an approval. Now, that is without anybody objecting to what you were doing. That's no plan, no contest, no nothing. It was 58 weeks. Of course, the things that was going on that were also strange, and I'll address later on. Well, we also had a recession. That's what you're dealing with now. It's strange to me that it's not mentioned that we had a recession in 1982. They talk about the Great Depression. Your unemployment is about 8%, I think, something like that. In 1982, it was 12.7% unemployment. We were the second or third highest in the nation, Oregon was. Inflation was running at 13%. Interest rates were running over 20%. And I hope that you can come to the kind of conclusion dealing with this problem as we did then. We had one special session in 81, and that was relatively easy to cut. We had three sessions, special sessions, in 82. We cut budgets, and we cut them again, and we cut them again, and we raised a little revenue here and there. When I say little revenue, however, we did pass a surtax. Now, I'm a Republican governor, and we had a Democrat in control of the legislature. As a matter of fact, my whole career, the Democrats controlled. The only time it became Republican is when I ran for the Senate, and one in the House went Republican. But anyway, people trusted us. We said, we'll have a surtax for 3 years. We passed it in the legislature, and there was no contest of it at all. They said, yeah, we believe you. And we eliminated it in 3 years. And we went on economic development. And if that, incidentally, there was a lot of tax measures and property tax measures, but if that was not enough excitement, the Rajneesh came to town.
That's right.
And they were very abrasive, very upsetting, terrible people. We had good intelligence. They were really awful people. They were very arrogant. People would come to me, now I'm governor, they say, you've got to do something about those folks. They got guns. Well, I said, I didn't know they have guns. Of course, we did know they had guns. We knew what they were. But I said, what do you want me to do? Every pickup that goes up and down the freeway has a gun on the back. That means that they can't have guns, but you can have guns. I said that was a great test of a democracy. You can't just do it because you don't like them as much as you like. I carried around with me two executive orders declaring a state of emergency, just waiting for my signature. No matter where I was, I could sign that thing. And I had the National Guard in training. Now, I seem like I'm, this is not a walk down memory lane. Really, all I'm trying to tell you is that, point that the opportunities that we had, and that's a word that I used many times as governor, and they've all come before. The ones you face, they've come before. I use the word opportunity. You have an opportunity. An opportunity is a kind of an exciting thing. You can't say we have a problem with land use. That's heavy. We got an opportunity. Although I would tell you, the third special session, my staff said to me, Governor, this is no longer an opportunity. But you need to face, Thomas Paine said, this is a time that tries men's soul, but this is not in my way of saying, this is not a time for someone to turn into, have their mind into a windsock mentality, which way is the wind blowing. Now, land use, your opportunity has seen many changes, really many changes. Some major by legislative passage, which certainly was last session, and some by petition. Minor ones, mostly legislative. I don't know if you have, I have with me, and I'll leave with you, all the different legislations that happened, little pieces, and what they were. I'll leave it with you.
Thank you. Do we have that history? Great.
It always made it strange. Here we had a law of land use, and you couldn't, a son couldn't, or a daughter couldn't build a home on the family farm. Why? I remember traveling with the Deschutes County Commissioner between Redmond and Bend, and he was saying to me, and they say this is ag land. You could see the lava rock sticking up out of the ground. I said to my friends, in the land use, I said, you're making it awful tough for those of us that support land use to come up with some of these things that you're doing. That's why it's created all the changes, and that's why you folks are in business now. That's why some changes need to be made, but it has to be made in the sense that we don't ask these people out there to use their own opinion, and which many did. The law is the law. I don't know if you know this. We passed, you passed, the express measure last session. because I had a friend that was involved with this express, I happened to know one, kept track of what was happening. And I'm trying to remember, about 15 or 16 months later, not one approval left the department. Not one. That's not express. That's not what you meant. But now I'm talking about the bureaucracy. I said, I want to talk to the governor. Well, what is the message? I don't want to leave a message. I want to talk to the governor. I want him to know what happened. Well, I get a little excited. Now, what do I propose? I don't want you to relive the agony of that session. But make absolutely certain that what you do and what you promise will actually happen. There were folks out there who were promised an express, and they didn't have it. That's why it's tough for us in political office to have any kind of integrity or belief in us. So what do I propose? Well, a year and a half before the last session, Governor Roberts and I worked with those that supported the measure that did pass and were trying to fix, and talked to others about what we ought to be doing. And then, of course, the legislature cranked up, and you dealt with that all session long. But Governor Roberts and I and others, of course, and we finally came up with a report. Mm-hmm. And we sent it down here. And we never got any acknowledgement at all. We got it, came in the mail, or whatever. No acknowledgement. I suppose it's a matter of ego, but when there are two governors sent down a message to the legislature, at least you'd think they would say, we got it. Well, I don't expect you to change the world, or at least you shouldn't attempt to. There's been this study now in the interim. You've heard from a lot of people. I think if you sort out the, what I call the porcupine quills of what you've heard, and try to deal with those that you think are the things that you ought to deal with, to make life more livable for you who believe in land use planning, as I do, it is important. I used it, our land use planning, as a part of my economic talk to those that are looking at Oregon. I'd say Oregon's a good place. You can come here, you know that property is available, you know what's going to happen around you. And beyond that, it's just good for us. And I'm going to finally, I'm going to quit. Which, of course, doesn't mean immediately. But I wanted to tell you one thing, and I say this now in terms of what you're dealing with, not only in this question, but this session, please, if you let me do this. And this is a quote that I've kept and used from time to time to maybe kind of make people kind of strengthen them up a little bit. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? There comes a time when one must take a position that's neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but take it because it's right. Now that, I believe, is Martin Luther King said that. And I've kept track of it. And life will be so much livable for all of you, because you're intelligent and do what's right. Whatever you feel like, do what's right. I hope that helps you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Governor. We have two other panel members. If there are questions for the governor, we could take them now, or we could invite our two other panelists. And Mr. Governor, can you stay with us for a little bit?
I'll stay for a while, yes.
Great.
But you can ask any question you like.
Representative Greenwick?
Thank you, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for coming, Governor. It's always such a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
There's a legal concept, and I don't know the exact concept, but it's something like bad facts make bad law. Is that? See, we have an attorney down here. Is that something like that?
No, hard cases make bad law.
Hard cases.
Well, one of the things that I've observed in two sessions on the land use committee is there have been some pretty stupid land use decisions made by both county and state government. I thought at one point I'd like to get one of those stickers, you know, that says stamp out bad land use decisions. And whenever somebody comes in from Medford and tells us this story that he bought some land in 78 and he could build on it, and then he checked again in 82 and he could build on it, and then he checked again in 96 and he can build on it, and then he went to get a building permit and they said, oh no, you can't build on it, and you never could, and you just wonder how in the world something like that can happen. And their answer always is, well, we need to do away with all these land use regulations because of that case. How do we sort out the fact that human beings make bad decisions even in the face of good policy standards? And how do we deal with the question of making the process more reasonable that faces people at the same time keeping good land use planning principles in place?
Well, I wish I could really answer the question, except that I believe the bureaucracy in their positions they've had, city, county, state, were interpreting according to what they wanted, not necessarily according to the law. And that's why I said earlier, you're making it tough for us who do believe in land use planning to continue to believe in land use planning. There's some, well, when I'd have my staff meetings, and every once in a while something would come up, like the question you're asking, but the kind of thing that involves, and I just say, it's dumb.
Yeah.
Common sense couldn't call for that. It's dumb. It's part of the frustration that you have as an elected official, and I have as an elected official. And there are some dumb things that happen. But we have to understand, when we passed the land use law in 1973 and said everybody had to have an acknowledged plan, there weren't that number of competent land planners in the entire nation, let alone Oregon. A young man who was my driver of my first campaign, which I didn't win. Bright young man.
I didn't win my first one either.
I didn't win. Oh, I could tell you that. Bright young man. He tells me he was, and I won't pick the county, but it was not rural, but not too far from this, our Multnomah County. He was the land use planner. You were the planner? He never had anything to do with planning. He was bright, but he surely didn't have anything to do with it. Well, that's the kind of thing that's going on. And that's a problem. I think you, as an elected official, you members of the House and the Senate, you have to say, now, to the bureaucracy, this is what we mean. We want you to do it. You got to keep track of it. I talked to the LCD, the department. I talked to them. I said, I can't believe it. He said, we have 4,000 of these waiting to go out. Now we're talking about 15 months later. Should have happened. That's not express. Well, that's not long. I should learn to give you short answers, but it's hard to do that. Really, I don't know if you have any other questions.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Governor.
Mr. Governor, we do have two people who have been responsible for trying to take the vision and policy that the legislature has enacted and put it into action through the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I've invited Arnold Kogan, who was charged with taking the vision of Senate Bill 100 and establishing the Department of Land Conservation and Development as its first director, and I'd like for him to give us a bit of the flavor of what it took to take this grand vision and put it on the ground, literally, in all 36 counties.
That's why we both have gray hair.
Mr. Kogan, would you like to join the governor at the witness table?
Okay, get up. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. Again, for the record, I'm Arnold Kogan. At the current time, I'm managing principal of my consulting firm, Kogan Owens Kogan, in Portland. I had two experiences with state government, which brought me to the position of having a role in writing these goals. My first experience was in the late 60s when Tom McCall was elected governor. It was in 1967. And I think Governor Attia will remember this, that one of the first things that Governor McCall asked the legislature to do was to change the law that created the State Department of Planning and Economic Development, take the planning out and leave it just economic development, and move planning into his office. And he relished the idea that he then became the chief planner of the state. And it was one of his, I think, besides being governor, I think he did relish that position, that title very much. But in order to carry out the function, he hired me shortly after that law was passed to be the state planning coordinator in his office. And one of the first things we started to do was to work with members of the legislature to write the initial bills or the initial laws that would create a land use program. And they ultimately, in the 1969 session, became Senate Bills 10, 11, 12, and 13. Only 10 survived. Unfortunately, if 11, 12, and 13, if they had survived, we would have had at least the beginning of a land use program in 1969 instead of in 73. But be that as it may, Senate Bill 10 at least was a beginning. Frankly, not a very good beginning because it had a lot of flaws to it without the other bills to accompany it. But that was a start. And then finally, in 73, of course, Senate Bill 100 was passed, as the governor has described, with a great deal of support from a wide variety of sources, agricultural, environmental, landowners. A wide coalition of parties were supporting that. And it wasn't without some struggle for it to get through the legislature, but it passed that session. And so my initial job, after the bill was passed and I was hired to be the first director of the department, the initial job was to write the goals. Everyone wondered at the time, why are we writing goals? We can always come up with goals. But the goals in the language of the time were ultimately to be regulations. They were going to be incorporated into the administrative rules and to be used to guide cities and counties and later Metro in the Portland region to create comprehensive plans. So that's what we did. Was to begin that process. And we decided early on that this needed to be a process that involved all the people of the state. And so one of the things that we decided to do was to have a strong process of input from the citizens and have a bottoms-up approach. What we did then was to blanket the state with a very small staff. We were fortunate to have the land use bill passed, but we were not fortunate to have a very big budget. In fact, we had a very small budget. And so we enjoyed the volunteer activity of the commission itself, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and a citizens advisory committee, all of whom donated a great deal of their time to travel around the state with the small staff that I had. I think, as I recall, we had about 6 or 7 people on our staff. Before we really even had an office, we rented 2 vans, and we blanketed the state in about a 2-month period to 35 cities in the state, where we began talking with folks in these communities about what they thought these goals should look like. And we asked the people in the central Oregon part of the state what they thought about other parts of the state, the coast and the gorge and southern Oregon. And we similarly asked people on the coast what they thought of central Oregon and so forth. In addition to the people we met with in these communities, we decided we needed to be able to communicate with many more than that. We didn't have enough budget to direct mail contact with everybody. But there were about 1 million voters, registered voters in the state at that time. We did have enough budget to select at random about 10%, 100,000 people. And we began a series of direct mails to those 100,000 people, and we did that 5 times throughout 73, all of 74, and into the beginning of 75. And what we told them was that these meetings were being held around the state. We gave them progress reports about what we were trying to do. We regionalized these direct mails so that it applied to specific parts and their personal familiar parts of the state. And what we found was that we had a wonderful reception from the direct mails. We asked people to write to us and tell us what they thought. A typical day in each city that we visited, we always saw either the local newspaper editor and members of staff. If there was a television or radio station, we visited that. A principal industry, met with the city council and county board of commissioners and so forth. The League of Women Voters helped us with a lot of these meetings, again, because we didn't have the staff to set up the time and space. And we have the same format for every one of those initial 35 meetings. There were generally workshops, and we divided the group into small tables so that everybody could have a chance to talk and give us their feedback. And we even prioritize all of their comments. This is the first time, I think. You're probably all familiar going to meetings where you can vote with dots. And you can 5 dots for the high priority and 2 dots for a lower priority. That's when we began using these dots, and we used them everywhere. People really got a kick out of that. They really, I think, enjoyed the idea to be able to participate and vote with their dots. When we came back from those 35 meetings, we digested, synthesized all that material, put it together and organized it under the different goal categories, agricultural, economic development, housing, and so forth. And then, in order to be able to work with that material, we asked the LCDC, the commission, to appoint 14 committees, 14 task forces, one for each goal. And each task force was staffed by a member of our staff or a volunteer, and the expert people who were on those task forces began to write the goals. And in about 2 months, we had enough material to go back to those 35 cities again. And we did this 3 times as we wrote those goals. All this time, we began to get mail back from a substantial number of the direct mail, those 100,000 mailers that we were sending out. And so it was kind of interesting when we were all done, finished writing the goals by the end of 74. All of this happened within a 12-month period. We contacted, we actually met face-to-face with 10,000 people. We got back mail from a substantial portion of those 100,000 direct mail. This is at a time when we didn't have the electronic gadgets that we have today. But the person-to-person contact really was pretty powerful. And frankly, I'm convinced that it was one of the reasons why in the 70s and 80s, when 3 ballot measures came up to dissolve the land use program, They were all defeated by substantial margins. It's quite a difference when Measure 7 and 37 came up years later. The democratization of our program really was a key to the success that it enjoyed and the support that it enjoyed. We ran several public opinion polls during this time also, and we found enormous support for what we had done. People felt a part of it. They felt ownership. The local press, the local civic organizations, business organizations that came to our meetings and supported it and participated, all felt a part of the process. So I thought that gave you some idea of at least that process that we went through to get the goals written. Obviously, in the intervening years, many changes have happened. Dick Benner can tell you more about some of that. Succeeding legislatures and court decisions, revisions of the administrative rules, all of that has had quite an impact. I just wanted to close with one thought. Before I left DLCD, I wrote up a report to close out my career with DLCD at that time, describing what we had accomplished, of course, the goals, and describing what I have just told you right now during that two-year period. The goals were the principal accomplishment, but also in that report, I recommended the need to develop a state growth policy, because it occurred to me and to several of us working on the program that what we were working on were rules and guidelines for local planning. It had nothing to do with a state plan. Sometimes people did confuse it, or at least confuse our functions, but as a state planning agency, but we weren't. We were an agency to prescribe and implement a local planning program. So a state growth policy that could guide state and local agencies when they make decisions about where growth should be stimulated, both in terms of carrying capacity and in resource protection. And such a growth policy, of course, wasn't adopted, but the need to do it is still there. And I think that we all felt that that was an important part. Governor McCaul, when he addressed that 1973 session of the Oregon legislature to prepare them for the land use bill that was to be considered, he spoke of our need to be forever vigilant. I just wanted to close with a quote so you can get a flavor for the kinds of things that Governor McCaul had a knack of saying. I mean, he could turn a phrase. And what he said was at least one of the sentences that he said: "The interests of Oregon for today and in the future must be protected from the grasping wastrels of the land." So I'll close with that.
Indeed.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Before you do that, unless there's a particular question, I'd like to invite Dick Benner up as well. I'm giving a little bit of a initial kind of germination of this idea, and then the first implementation, and then fast-forwarding about 15 years. Dick was the director of DLCD during the 90s. As this system had evolved and been tweaked and adjusted and trying to, keep pace with different changing backgrounds. So how was life in the 1990s on this issue, Mr. Benner?
Thanks. Well, if coming down here today has done anything for me, it's made me feel a little older. And it's not because I'm sharing company with people who were there when I was there. It's thinking about 35 years of a land use program, and as Arnold was talking about the remarkable effort that little department made in 1974 to engage Oregonians, he reminded me that I was a law student at the time in Eugene, and I attended one of those workshops. It was at LCC, which was pretty new at that time. I sat at one of your round tables, and I put blue dots up on the wall, one under should we protect agricultural land, and another one should we have compact cities. And I feel good that we won. I put the dots in the right place.
Would you let our recording system know who you are? I forgot to mention that.
My name is Dick Benner. I work at Metro, and for between 1991 and 2001, I served as director of the department. Given that you don't have too much time, and that's a lot of years to think about how the program evolved and changed, what I did is I just created a little outline for you, and I'll try to touch on those things, some of the themes of a young program, an adolescent program, moving toward maturity. And as I look at you, some of you were actually alive when the land use law passed, and some of this will be familiar to you.
Why is he looking at you and I?
Few of us, maybe not.
All right.
And some of you were paying attention and watching these things unfold. And you know, if you looked at the program as it existed in 1975, let's say 2 years after the statute and after the goals had been adopted, and you wanted to read, you could have read the entire program by reading a few pages of statute and a couple of pages of statewide planning goals. And today, if you wanted to read the program, just the portions of the statutes having to do with farm and forest land are 35 pages of statutes. And the rules, the LCDC rules, if you pick up that volume, it's probably a half an inch thick. And you start to think of the Internal Revenue Code a little bit. But you know, Arnold and I, and a lot of other people probably behind me, lived through that. And when you think about what happened to go from those few pages to those many pages, it's part of the story of the evolution of the program, and I'm going to touch upon that. So I want to talk about three themes of those years. One is things moved from the simple to the complex. A second one is the focus of the program tended to go from big picture to little picture. And a third one is that in spite of the impression that a lot of people have that we adopted it in 1973-75 and didn't change it, and it's been there for 35 years and now it's time to bring it up to date, that isn't the way I remember it. I think of the 35 years as a time of continuous correction. And just focusing on that for a moment, if your perspective is over those 35 years, did anything about the program change in a really profound way? Then the answer is no. When it was conceived and passed in Senate Bill 100 and in Senate Bill 101, this is a curiosity of the beginning of the program, you can read Senate Bill 100 and look for the big picture that the two previous folks have talked about, and you won't really find it in Senate Bill 100. Senate Bill 100 talked mostly about coordination of planning. If you wondered where urban growth boundaries came from, where did the policy of the state to protect working landscapes, farm and forest lands, outside of urban growth boundaries, you don't find it in Senate Bill 100. You find it in Senate Bill 101, which was a companion bill, one of the five bills that the McCaul administration introduced. And this was the one that was aimed at farmland protection. And there's a provision. There was a provision in Senate Bill 101 that's still in the statute today. And if you're wondering what it's all about, look at 215.243. That's, you'll find in there the purposes of Senate Bill 101, also the purposes of the state planning program as a whole. It talks about protecting agricultural land. It talks about compact cities with efficient services. Those were the principal impulses really behind the program. And again, when you look back over 35 years, has there been fundamental change to the land use program? The answer is no. That's really what the program is still about. If you start talking about details, on the other hand, there have been very significant changes and continuous changes over the 35 years. I think you heard Governor Attia say that he would leave you with a list. I have that same list. There's a land use lawyer in the state known to most of you. He's a very well-respected and highly regarded land use lawyer, Edward Sullivan. And believe it or not, he has kept track of and made a list of and sorted all the revisions to the statutes, the land use statutes, since 1973, and he counts over 1,000. So you'll see those on the list. But this evolution from the simple to the complex, why did it happen? How did it happen? It certainly wasn't deliberate. Nobody sat down and said, well, we got this simple program, let's see how complicated we could make it so that nobody could understand it. That was not one of the objectives of the program. It was rather a relatively, I would say, natural outcome of the program that was conceived, the way it was designed. And I've got a couple of pointers here in my outline that I'll mention. We set up a program with a state agency, and we charged the state agency to review city and county comprehensive plans to ensure that they were consistent with statewide planning goals. That was the model. Well, if you think about that process, a city, maybe a city you live in, Medford, spending a good amount of time working on its comprehensive plan with 14 statewide planning goals that were written in goal-type language, sort of aspirational, with not a lot of detail, and you finish your plan and you send it to the agency, and the agency is supposed to determine whether this is consistent with the 14 statewide planning goals. How do you know if the statements and the goals are relatively general? I'll give you an example. To protect agricultural land, that was one of the goals. There was some attention to land divisions, naturally. Because if you divide your farmland into little tiny parcels over time, it's really no longer suitable for commercial agriculture. So the language in Goal 3 was, make sure that your minimum lot size in your farm zones is sufficient to protect the existing commercial agricultural enterprise in your area. So Lane County finishes its comprehensive plan and sends it down with a 10-acre minimum lot size or a 20-acre minimum lot size. Is that sufficient to protect the existing commercial agricultural enterprise in the area? Well, that was the question that was presented to the agency. And there were farmers coming in and land use advocates saying that's not sufficient. And there were other people coming in to say that's too large a lot size. So the agency had to kind of sort it out. And if you're doing these by the scores, the dozens, the hundreds of plans, you make decisions. Well, there were no rules at that time, in 1973 through 1980, when all these plans were flooding the agency. And the agency began to make decisions. Well, how does Portland know about the decision made about Bend? How are they recorded? And the agency began to put out what were called white papers. And the white paper would be maybe 5 or 6 pages long, and it would try to explain what this new vague test was about commercial agriculture. And then the lawyers said, well, you know, it's administrative law in the state of Oregon requires you to turn these into rules. You can't run an agency with white papers. These have to be turned into rules. And that started that half-inch thick volume that became Oregon Administrative Rules. And there were a lot of vague terms, and each one of these had to be interpreted. And again, they started in white papers and they ended up in rules. And the more they were interpreted, the more questions arose. There was a quest from many quarters for greater certainty about these terms. And among the reasons were, if you're a planning commissioner from Ontario and you're wondering how you're going to do your plan to meet these statewide planning goals, it would sure help you if you knew what the heck they meant. So you were looking for a little bit more guidance than a very brief statement. And slowly but surely, the guidance started to come out in these rules. And if you were a lawyer representing a landowner and you wanted to offer some kind of certainty or security to your client, it would help you a lot if you had a little bit clearer language. There was one particular participant in the planning process, the home builders, who saw great value for their members in this land use planning program as it was unfolding, because there was a goal. One of the first goals was housing, and it called upon all communities in the state to make sure that they provided opportunities for a full range of housing types. Not everything in every city could be 10,000 square foot lots with detached single family dwellings. Not everybody could afford that. Well, the home builders were among the first people to come to LCDC and to come to the legislature saying, what we need, what our members need, are clear and objective standards so we know what we're dealing with. Could you please change the laws to make things clearer and more objective? Later in the 70s, Governor Attia talked about recession in the late 70s, early 90s. Goal 9, the economy of the state, kind of came alive. A lot of business interests became interested in it, and they realized that they too could benefit from the land use program. And there was a great emphasis placed upon certainty for them. Is there something that could distinguish the business climate in the state of Oregon from business climates in California and Washington? Well, maybe the state planning program, by providing some kind of certainty, particularly for the high-tech industry. That's really what the state was fishing for in the early 80s. Yes, Goal 9 and comprehensive plans that were consistent with Goal 9 could offer some certainty and security. One more element added to this evolution from simple to complex. We had a number of policymakers acting in the game. In fact, I call it here the all-branch policy cycle. The legislature gave general direction. This is the way things work in a lot of areas of law. The legislature provides some guidance, expects a state agency to fill in the interstices, if you will, to make it operational. And then there are lawsuits, and then the court gets involved, and it interprets a term, and it interprets the term maybe a little bit differently from the way the legislature wanted or the way the agency wanted. So the agency or the legislature responds, and they change the statute to be a little bit more detailed, to say a little more carefully what it meant, or the LCDC would refine its rule. And you think about that cycle over 30 to 35 years, and again, you go from your 10 pages to your 100 pages. And that's still going on today. From the big picture to the little picture, Arnold was talking about going to the citizens of the state and talking at a very lofty level. What are we trying to accomplish with our land use planning? And I mentioned that the two fundamentals, really, we would like our cities not to sprawl out onto our working farmland and forest land. And I think about that very wonderful and lofty aspiration, and then I think about a statute that was enacted by the legislature. It's in 215.311, amended the exclusive farm use zone to authorize the parking of log trucks in farm zones. That's the small picture. You'd be surprised, of those 1,071 amendments made to the statutes that Ed Sullivan counted, how many of them are, can you park a log truck in a farm zone? The continuous corrections, I think I mentioned that. Three themes about the mature program. And what I'm thinking about is, in the early 90s, things, some new forces came to play and continue to affect the program today, all three of which I have listed here I think are very positive. One is people began to realize there was a limitation to what could be accomplished by regulations. The program, through this evolution that I was talking about, became highly regulatory. And people began to understand that regulations, they're good for stopping things you don't want. They're not particularly good for getting the things built that you do want. You could almost separate them by where the urban growth boundary is. Inside the urban growth boundary, you know, the program has generally been about releasing the market so that it can do what the market wants to do. Remove limitations on housing types and densities. Let things, new kinds of housing types, smaller lots, if that's what people want, relaxing regulations to let the market work. And so we've seen growing reliance on tools other than regulations, incentives, and investments to make the program work, particularly on the urban side of the urban growth boundary. And we've moved successively, and when I say we, I mean not only at the state level, but at the city and county zoning level, even more there, really, than at the state level. Instead of saying it's got to be 20 feet or a particular other kind of standard like that, increasingly there are performance standards which say to the owner of the land, for example, you don't have to do it in one particular way, but what we want you to do is to make sure however you do it, you get to a certain standard. And that's also found its way into the statewide planning goals and rules. I'll give you an example. The transportation planning rule that was adopted by LCDC in the early 90s wanted to try to reduce what seemed to be at that time complete reliance on the private automobile for all trips. Does it have to be that way? Can we shift some of that reliance to other modes of transportation, transit, walking, cycling? So instead of adopting rules that say you have to do this and you have to do that, the agency said, let's try to achieve in the larger metropolitan areas, percentage reduction in reliance on the single occupancy vehicle, and you do it your way. Just try to get to that performance standard. That's what I'm talking about. That's been a trend, and it continues, and I think it's gaining momentum. Another one is the role of government. In 1973, the role that was conceived was getting into the business of planning. And again, sometime in the 90s, I think a number of people, including the governor, starting with Governor Goldschmidt, continuing with Roberts and Kitzhaber, and since, actually, how about if the government leads by example? If we're trying to build compact communities, if we're trying to make them so that we can provide transportation facilities that are efficient, wouldn't it make sense if we put government offices in the parts of the city where transit is provided? So there were executive orders enacted by those governors saying to the agencies, when you're thinking about building a new office, tell us, look for a place in the center. Look for a place where there is transit, where people can get there other than by a single occupancy vehicle. In coordination of investments, this was oddly a novel idea at the end of the 80s and the early 90s. You have, a dozen state agencies making significant investments which consciously or unconsciously influence land use patterns and either reinforce or detract from the goals of the statewide planning program. Well, how about if we thought consciously when making these investments about what the impacts are going to be? How about if we coordinate them? Because if they're coordinated, they might reinforce one another, and in fact, the investment by one agency might help another agency accomplish its goals. So there was in the mid-90s, the Kitzhaber administration wrote and adopted an integration and investment strategy that was an effort to coordinate the investments of those five agencies whose actions most affected land use patterns: DEQ, Economic Development, LCDC, Housing, and who did I leave out?
ODOT.
DEQ.
ODOT, I think.
ODOT. How could I leave ODOT out? They're number one, I think. And the last trend, the recognition that land use planning and transportation planning are inextricably tied, and they can both be done much more successfully if they are done together. And that happened when the transportation planning rule was adopted by LCDC in 1992, and in subsequent years, transportation and land use agencies got together and developed the Transportation and Growth Management Program and began to help cities and counties think about transportation and land use planning together, and I think very successfully so. So I've probably used enough of your time, and I'd be happy to join these gentlemen in answering your questions.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Are there questions for any members of the panel? Representative Quinn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming. This isn't so much about the inside portions of the urban growth boundary, but the outside portions. And I would like to at least hear your views on how important other things we do in state government are to our ag lands and our forest lands beyond land use planning. I mean, is it enough to just zone something agriculture, or our right to farm act, types of laws that protect some of the nuisance complaints that would otherwise occur in agriculture, inheritance tax policy around what happens when it's time to pay the inheritance tax bill to a large spread, forest practices type regulatory activities? I mean, is it really truly enough just to zone it, or do you have to actually have a conducive climate, period, across the board when talking about natural resource industries?
Let me take a shot at that. During my time at the department, I remember there was a great deal of interest, say in the mid-90s, on agricultural protection efforts around the country, comparing states, different programs, of course, lots of different ideas. And some of the think tanks, some of the American Planning Association and other bodies would review them, compare them, and make these lists of common elements from around the country. And zoning was always one of them, but it was only one. And the conclusions they came to were the best programs in the country. They had other elements too. For example, you touched on a couple of them. Almost all of them had a farm value assessment program, mm-hmm. so that the owner of a piece of farmland was not taxed as though tomorrow that land was going to be a shopping center, and effectively tax them out of farming. That was always listed as an element. Planning to complement the zoning. Longer range was often cited as an element. Right to farm legislation was often among the five or six or seven elements of successful programs. I am increasingly thinking that something that showed up as elements of programs around the state that we did not, around the country, excuse me, that we did not do was purchase of development rights and transferable development credits. More heavily relied upon in some states, not used here at all, in part because we relied heavily on planning and zoning. I think either one or both of those programs could be a significant complement to our system here, and I regret that we didn't get there sooner.
Anyone else on the panel want to address that?
Not that.
No, I think got it.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Back in the 70s, Jackson County hurried, which is a bad word when it comes to planning, to comply with the LCDC at that time and did a broad brush approach on zoning, with the intent of going back and re-evaluating the zoning at a later time. They have never done that. Today I can take you to several parcels out in the Sands Valley area, White City area, and it's just like Governor Attia said, the best thing it does is grow black widows and rocks, and yet it's EFU. What do we do about that? Because that's a breakdown in the system. That's a breakdown for the individual that owns the property of no value, and yet it's zoned EFU.
Arnold will
help me out here.
What I say. I participated in some of that early work when I was at 1,000 Friends of Oregon from 75 to 86, 87. And there was a lot, there were a couple of things that should have been done better. In part, along the lines that you were talking about, they said that Jackson County did it quickly, and Jackson County didn't really have enough resources to do a thorough job of evaluating its farm and forest land base against the goals. I know that because I watched it. And a couple of things happened. One, and there was more of this in the Willamette Valley than other parts of the state, there was this notion that you start with the soil maps, and they tell you where the better soils are and where the poorer soils are. But in fact, some of that stuff that shows up as pretty good soils, it's outside of the urban growth boundaries that were being drawn at that time, it's already, it really can't be farmed because it's already been broken into relatively small parcels, and a lot of them have houses on them. Those were exception lands. That's what they were called at the time. And when the county was developing its plan and preparing to submit it to LCDC for review, it was supposed to identify its exception lands, the lands that were maybe good soils but no longer appropriate because they'd been committed to some other use. And I watched counties struggle with the, there ended up about 850,000 acres around the state of these exception lands. And the analysis that was required to justify an exception for getting it out of a farm zone or out of a forest zone were pretty daunting, and they didn't have the resources to do it. And then they had people coming to the microphones at the hearings. Some of these people own these small parcels, and they said, don't change my zoning. I want to be in a farm zone because I want to be able to have easy access to farm value assessment and keep my taxes low. So please don't change my zoning, even though the county probably could have taken exception for that area and put it in a 2 or 5 acre zone. I'm convinced today there's still 100,000 acres out there like that that is today in a farm or forest zone and probably shouldn't be. On the question of what you're talking about is stuff out there that isn't really suitable for farm or forest use by its soils. It's just not
never has been
capable.
Right.
Something else was going on, also a product of not having enough money in the planning program to give to the county to take the time to do it right. Almost all those lands, think back to 1973, 1975, a different world in many respects, almost all of those bad soils, if you want to call them that, were parts of ranches. Somebody was passing cattle over that ground for a part of the year, and they were part of their operation. They weren't the best part of the operation. They may not even, if you'd broken them off, they might not even have been profitable. But the county planner, the planning commission, they're in a hurry. They don't have the resources. It was very easy just to say, and there weren't really growth pressures much on those lands back then, 35 years ago. The easy, natural thing to do is just to put it into the EFU zone. In the 90s, I guess, some counties began to make noise about looking at those lands again. Jackson County was one of them. I was director then, went around and looked at those places, probably some of the same places you're talking about, and said, you know, those places don't even meet the definition of agricultural land in Goal 3. Agricultural land under Goal 3 in Western Oregon is Class 1 through 4 soils plus other lands suitable. On the east side of the mountains, it's 1 through 6 plus other areas that are suitable or used commercially. Well, a lot of the stuff that I was looking at in Southern Oregon was Class 7, some Class 8. It was in somebody's ranch just because the fence went out that way. And we suggested to the counties that they look again at those areas and make the case to the agency that they weren't even covered by the agricultural lands goal. About 6 months ago, because I was making some comment to the Big Look Task Force, I called the agency, and maybe you ought to do this, Madam Chair, to see if you can get better data than I was able to get. These lands were called non-resource lands, mm-hmm. lands that were in farm and forest zones, didn't meet the definition of farm and forest land, came out of farm and forest zones over the last 15 years. And what I was told by the agency about 6 months ago is that there are seven counties that now that have, I think it was about 100,000, 150,000 acres of non-resource lands. You could get the agency to come over here and tell you what's been happening with that notion, but I think that's part of the answer to your question.
We'll certainly have plenty of time to talk to the agency. Mr. Governor?
This is a good exercise, Madam Chairman. Really, from me, talking about beyond land use planning,
yes.
and pardon me, into this gentleman that's talking about the small screws. I would suggest to you that don't get mired down in minutiae.
Thank you.
Think about common sense is a good word. You know, does it make really sense? And that's really basically what you have to deal with. It would be a real problem to get mired down. He knows so much about what I don't want to know about. It's like the one that says, what time is it? And they'll tell you how to make a watch. It's just that we just have to, you know, this where you're going to deal with common sense is your best tool. And just like I told the planners when I met with them at times, when you put that green pen or pink pen or red pen, there's people down there.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, there are people down there. They don't like to be bothered with people. This is a good exercise.
It is.
And I thank you for the opportunity. I will give you this. This is very good.
That would be very helpful, and we'll make it available to the committee. I want to make sure that the governor can get on the road north when he wants to. You're welcome to stay as long as you'd like, Mr. Governor. But if you need to get heading north, you're welcome to
thank you.
Do that as you wish. Further questions for our panel? Representative Clem.
Just one, to the common sense point.
Thanks.
You know, the last point about you know, non-resource lands, secondary lands, exception lands, I forget what all they are, but the junky soil out in the middle of somewhere that got miszoned EFU, from a common sense level, does it make sense to, because it's surrounded by farmland, but it isn't, pop down 10 houses on quarter acre lots right there? What does that do to the neighboring farmers, or is that the best use of that land?
No.
You want to impanel them? Gentlemen, would you join us on this side of the dais? Mr. Governor, maybe you'd like to come back into the legislature. It's an important question.
I'll read about you in the news.
Thank you all very, very much for being here.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we have, as I said, some more background that I would like to make available to you. Next Tuesday, we will have a panel representing some of the users of the land. I don't have the exact panel established yet, but we will hear from agricultural interests and forest interests and business interests, and I'm sure there are others. But we will have a panel that helps make this a little more real in terms of the effect of the kinds of decisions that state land use goals create for local planning. I would like also to invite your suggestions as we plan the rest of the background meetings for the committee. I have to submit to the speaker a work plan for the committee, as any of my colleagues who are chairing other committees know. Among the pieces of that are the issues that this committee wants to address. So I would welcome any of you who have particular issues that you want this committee to spend some time on to let me know about that. Clearly, and the speaker has already told me, the report from the Big Look Task Force will be
a major part of our work for this session, and the bills introduced to implement their recommendations will be work that we will have before us.
But are those bills being prepared now?
They will be submitted by the agency, and in fact, I think they may have been dropped yet, but I don't know the exact status. So
there'll be a package of bills intended to implement this?
Yes, yes. If there are other issues you want to make sure that this committee has an opportunity to address, let me know that. This will be an evolving thing, the work plan, but the sooner you get those on in front of me, the sooner I can get them to the speaker, and the more likely it is that this committee will actually have an opportunity to address them. The other invitation I would extend is if there are perspectives, either a type of interest that you'd like to make sure comes forward. I've already extended an invitation to the Association of Realtors, to the Farm Bureau, as I mentioned. But if there are other interests you'd like to make sure we hear from, let me know that. Or if there are particular speakers you think can provide value for the committee, let me know that. I cannot promise that every single suggestion will make it on an agenda, but I'll try to accommodate the interests of the committee as I make those plans. Representative Greenlick.
Madam Chair, there is an issue that still keeps popping up, and that's the fact that there was background legislation that dealt with the notion that if people lived in areas where they wanted to receive urban services, then they needed to be a part of the city. And in some counties, there are now highly developed service provider models for delivering those services for people who don't live in cities. A little more than half of my district is in the urban growth boundary, but is not incorporated, and receives a set of services under a somewhat archaic set of rules about what single districts can be doing. Some way it seems to me we need to look at that assumption, find out whether that assumption still holds, whether that's a correct approach, and if so, move the urbanization issue as a specific issue, and if not, find ways to validate the fact that there are other approaches for dealing with urbanization in areas that are served by county service districts. I don't know how to bring this up in a specific way, but it is a piece of things that relates to Lane County, certainly Washington County, probably Marion. Klamath County, and maybe Marion County, where these remain very touchy issues boiling around, and it would be good if we could have some way to look at that.
Okay, that would be a good suggestion to submit. I'm submitting my initial work plan to the speaker at the end of the day tomorrow. So if you have initial ideas, let me know. As I said, it will be an evolving effort, so tomorrow is not your last opportunity. It's just your first and best opportunity.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Would you like us to get those concerns out on the record or
just send them to Cheyenne.
Or?
Okay. And just so you're not surprised, I will not be here next Tuesday. We will still be meeting, and Representative Garrett will have his first opportunity to chair a committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no further business, we are adjourned until Tuesday.
Don't give me that bad time.